I'm Pat Allwell, and I'm joined with my two good friends, well,
Right.
acquaintances, really. I work with them. Well, I know them. Todd Sohn, who does our ETF and technical work, and Ryan Gabrinsky, who is going to be doing even greater things in terms of the equity work that we do. Ryan, what's the most important thing that struck you this week?
I mean, I think it continues to be the 10-year yield. There's a lot of discussions about what direction it's going. With the softer CPI prints that we saw this week, a lot of investors thought that it would be the yield would move down, and we actually got the opposite reaction. I think the biggest question that we're getting outside of anything related to Washington is when does the Fed step in with the Fed put, given that the equity markets are seeing some drawdowns here. And to be quite frank, it feels as though we need to feel more pain before the Fed ultimately is going to step in. Overall, we're more of the camp of two cuts this year, whereas the market is pricing somewhere between three or four.
I did. Don did add a third cut to our own forecast. I saw that, which is consistent perhaps with the slowdown and weaker economic activity. Todd, what are you seeing technically here in the market? It's been a momentum market from the get-go, and has momentum broken here?
Yeah, you've had a pretty good unwind, especially from the momentum winners. S&P now, we were what, in official correction territory. You had a decent spike in 20-day lows last week. I would hesitate to call it a major flush, but between the VIX curve inverting, the surveys getting very bearish, some modest signs of life from put call data, inverse ETF volume really swelled recently. That's all things that are indicative of a short-term low. I think it's going to matter what does the bounce look like. We have pretty good breadth today as of 2 o'clock. But ultimately, we're dealing with a definitely different trend backdrop than earlier in the cycle. So the bar's higher here going forward.
So I know that you and Chris this morning hosted a well-attended call, and you Chris mentioned something that sort of was like a clap of thunder to me, which was that over the past 2 years, gold has outperformed the triple Qs. It hit over 3,000 today. What do you think gold's telling us, if anything, here?
What is gold telling us? Frankly, I don't know. You could make it be about geopolitics. You could make it be about central banks buying it. You can make up a whole bunch of different stories here. I think it's interesting that this latest leg up to new all-time highs is now being accompanied by pretty good money flowing into gold ETFs. So that's suggestive that retail is coming in, right? Or maybe some model portfolios are finally adding it to their offerings. And so gold's still one of the best trends out there, the performance as you mentioned, but I am wondering if it's becoming a little bit more of a consensus play, which that might become a headwind going forward here.
I do think your answer is correct. And the answer is it's B. It's central banks buying that they've driven it up, particularly the Chinese, I think, as they're trying to diversify. But I also saw an article in the FT. Actually, I was in the FT. It was in The Economist about Bolivia buying gold. They buy it back from their miners a little bit cheaper, but
Olivia.
pay them in cash. And the Bolivian miners need it. Bolivia, it's a country in South America. I've never been there, but I understand the food is fantastic. Let's
I
talk
think
about
I
the
think
10-year
I
note
think
again that.
I think they also I think Bolivia also said that they're going to be buying it throughout 2025 as well. So there's, that suggested that there might be some supportive central bank buying of the current of the commodity throughout the year.
Right. Obviously, Bolivia is a small country, small central
Right,
bank, probably buying a small amount of gold, but it's interesting. Now,
it
of
was a
course, the
billion.
other thing I want to mention about gold is that it's distorting the Atlanta Fed's GDP now estimate, which currently is down, I think, 2.6% year on year. What happens is when you get an import from another country, that's their GDP, it weakens our GDP. So when our imports of metal like gold go up, it depresses our GDP a little bit. And then it shows up in inventories. What specifically happened is there was an arbitrage, either because of anticipation of tariffs or some other reason having to do with melting down gold. London has different size gold bars than New York does, and you have to send them to Switzerland to have them melted down. I've heard this from a numismatist friend of mine. And as a result, gold flowed into the United States by the billions, and that created a trade flow, which has nothing to do with economics. When you take that out of the Atlanta Fed number, I think the number they're using is that growth is still flat in the quarter. It's not robust, but it's only 0.4. So it's not negative. I know that when the market saw that original 2.5% down print, the market grew quite nervous about it. So just giving that to your attention, that came from the Atlanta Fed, and I think it was one of the researchers there posted that on Twitter last week. So you should be aware about that with gold. The other thing about gold is Scott Bessent, before he shut down his T Square hedge fund and became Treasury Secretary, was long a lot of gold. Chris Verona asked the question. I think it's a good one. Does that mean that lower gold prices will tell you that the administration's efforts to restrain debt and bring inflation down is something he'd like to see? You have any thoughts on that, anybody?
I mean, I think that's abundantly clear. That's one of the objectives of the administration, of his, right? That's one of his three arrows. The 3% deficit is certainly something that he's aiming for. I think as investors, we have to keep in mind that we can't just do this. We do this immediately, right? It is going to take some time to get to that 3% level, because if you kind of go back to the imports, it skewed the GDP equation. Thinking about government spending over the last four years also skewed the GDP equation higher. And if we start cutting government spending, that leads to slower growth. And you have to also consider that the revenue that the government was spending also boosted consumption to a certain extent, because it employs a lot of individuals. It also provides a lot of funds to government contractors and so forth. So, both of those components are going to be slowing. So where do you have to, the question now is, where do the offsets to the upside potentially come from? There's been a lot of announcements of potential investment in the country, but we haven't, that's yet to be seen. I think it was the Honda plant in Indiana. That's not coming, that's not supposed to come online until 2028 or something. So it's not going to be immediate. And naturally, based on everything that's coming out of Washington, we're going to see a slower economy, and that has to be the base case now.
So can we talk about tariffs a little bit? There's some complaint about tariffs. Of course, the United States had periods really up into the 20th century where it relied, the majority of federal revenues came from tariffs, but that was when the federal government was 2% of GDP versus, I don't know what the number is now, 28, 30% of
29.
GDP. So first of all, we have a unique belief, we at Strategic, is that tariffs are more deflationary than inflationary. They raise prices up a little bit, then they restrict choices, and people get poorer from them if it's not accommodated by the Federal Reserve. But we had a guest at our morning meeting this morning who looked like a Civil War reenactor. And what he said was to read this Gillian Tett essay in the Financial Times about how there's some proposal or some discussion in the economic team of the White House to tax capital. Any thoughts there?
So admittedly, I didn't get a chance to read it yet. But I am wondering, one of the things that I'm starting to grapple with, even before, this sort of conversation, is how much, how much, what is the impact of the policy uncertainty on potential capital flows to the United States, even without taxing it? And that's largely because you've seen some of the politicians in Canada are now calling for the pension plans to actually say, to actually keep their investments within Canada rather than to US equities or the US more broadly. And I think that's important, because over the last 15 years, if you think about the share of the US market cap within the global indexes, it's only been on the rise. And if capital is not going to flow to the US, you may not see that same buy the dip to the technology sector that we've grown so accustomed to over the last 15 years. You could also make the argument that capital is going to probably stick in Europe a little more as well here, right? They're going down the path of more fiscal spending. Perhaps investors say, hey, this is going to be beneficial to our local industries, and we're going to actually invest in our local stock markets rather than sending it to the US equity capital markets. So, I think there's a lot of things, seeds that are being planted for the outperformance of international, perhaps maybe being more sustainable longer term. But one of the things that we haven't seen thus far, is we haven't seen any of the earnings growth estimates actually start to follow the share price appreciation. So you really have to start to see that in the fourth quarter and into 2026 for it to really show the durability. And perhaps, you know, that'll just take time for that to come through. And maybe that's what prices are indicating right now.
I did see, Ryan, a story in the Financial Times about how Chinese authorities had called in Walmart because Walmart leans on their suppliers every time there's a price increase. They're trying to keep the price increase from their consumers. So if there are tariffs, they're leaning on Chinese manufacturers not to raise that price, not to pass it along. So again, there's a huge dynamic here. But the Chinese authorities were saying, look, you've got to pass it along, I guess, to Walmart executives. And they've already put some other groups on like a watch list because they were resistant to passing along the full tariff to their customers.
Yeah,
So there's a big dynamic there.
let's face it. You and I know how tariffs work, and it's taxed on the price that come when it comes into the country, right? So if we're getting T-shirts from China, and maybe we're paying $2 for them, and you have a 10% tariff now, you add another 10%, you're looking at maybe 20, an additional 20 cents. T-shirts aren't going to go up 20 cents because of the tariff, right? T-shirts are going to go up. They'd go up $2 because gasoline prices increased and transportation costs were greater. There's other variables that are more impactful for the price increases rather than those 10% tariffs.
So let's, when you mentioned that a little bit.
I would say tariffs or not, you definitely see discretionary take a pretty good hit here across the board.
Yeah, I
And
mean, Walmart.
Walmart too.
Well, retail, I know Walmart's not in the retail index. Is that right? It's in something
It's
else. Is
not
that right?
in the discretionary, it's in a staple.
It's a
Yeah.
staple. It's in the staples because they sell so many groceries. So it just creates a complication here. So let's also pivot to China a little bit because we know the German news, which is that they're going to be breaking their handcuffs on spending for defense. They've reached an agreement with the Greens that where the Greens allowed it because the Greens got 50 billion euro of additional green spend for renewable energy. But it didn't look like they reopened up or talked about reopening up their nuclear power plants, which is something I think that Germany should do. But in China, they're doing the same thing. China is now pivoting to the consumer, right? They're saying that, gee, our consumer here is under pressure. Let's get them to spend a little bit more. There have been recommendations as to how they can do that for a long period of time, including instituting a broader social security payment system to the Chinese people. They appear to be rejecting that, but there's a focus there. So the Chinese stocks are moving up. They've had a great year, you know, the past year. I know that, Todd, that you observed that fairly closely. Is there any danger sign? Because you always think that Chinese stocks are a little bit like Lucy and Charlie Brown, right? That they pull the ball away.
Yeah, they rank highly in the technical work because they have breadth and momentum, but we know the history here is it's a very volatile market, so it's not one you can kind of set it and forget it. You just got to stick with this thing and know what your pain point is for Chinese stocks. I will say though, you look at a name like BYD, right? Some of the auto names there, and much better than here.
And much cheaper. When you see some of these Chinese
You
cars,
had to feed
it's
the beast,
amazing.
Todd. You
It's
had to feed
well, I'm not going to say
the
anything more. The Chinese cars, I think, are just absolutely amazing. But again, if they're going to spend more on the consumer and they're talking about boosting their borrowing to do it, they might boost their borrowing by go to 2% of GDP to 3% of GDP. Now, I recognize these are Chinese numbers, so we're talking more directional than the actual numbers. But again, more borrowing. The Germans are borrowing. Obviously, the French and the Italians and the Greeks and everybody else will borrow more. The United States budget deficit for January, for 1 month, was $318 billion. And I didn't see it covered on the front page of the paper. $318 billion. In 1987, we had a stock market crash that was attributed to two variables, the twin deficits, it was called, the budget deficit and the trade deficit. And in 1987, government fiscal year, which ended in September, the budget deficit was $148 billion. $318 billion for the month, I think that was the number. A staggering amount of
ETFs
debt we're
were,
adding here.
I mean,
ETFs were born out of that crash.
we have a spending problem.
Well, we have a spending problem, but we have to finance all this debt. We've
Well,
got to
that's
figure out
you
a
know
way to.
that's so this is you know this is going to be the big dilemma, right? It's how do we pay for all this going forward? And now that we're in a what appears to be a structurally higher interest rate environment, as some of the lower, the lower cost debt rolls off, we're only going to see interest expense move higher. This is the challenge of terming out the debt that we're going to be, feeling for many years to come. It comes back to, issuing that 50 or 100-year bond in 2021, 2022, when interest rates were 1.5, 2% on the long end, and there was zero appetite to increase interest expense at that point. And now, in hindsight's 2020, we would have been, ecstatic to have issued longer term debt at that point.
I'm wondering, Ryan, if that's a function of the shape of the curve rather than the levels, right? Because the Treasury has a cost if they're issuing, at that time, they were issuing bills at basically zero interest rates. So even if you issued a 10-year at 1.25, it had a cost from a budgetary point of view.
Well, that's exactly my point, because we would have essentially worked. Right now we have interest expenses, what, $800 million a year, and rising. If we had taken the hit then, it may have interest expense may have jumped from 100 to 300 or 400 million a year, but we would have locked in that number, right? So today, in theory,
It
today
wouldn't be right
we'd be
growth, yeah.
saving we'd be saving 200 or 300 million from the point at which interest rates are today. But there was no appetite then to do it, so now everyone is, still thinks there's no appetite. One of the interesting things is actually is that there this while we're still issuing bills right now, we've actually seen the interest expense fall by 4 or 5 basis points because of where bills were, say, 6 to 12 months months ago. So we're actually getting a little bit of savings here. But this is going to be we're going to be looking for we need to look for significantly more, and the only way to do that is attack the most the least the least political the most political items out there, and that's Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and defense spending. No politician
Well,
wants to go after any of those.
defense spending, I think they're going to go after the rest of the stuff, I think, is a neutron bomb, which kills all the politicians but leaves their districts alive. Todd, what are you seeing on the interest rate side? We've talked about technical level. What's the technical level on the S&P and 10-year? Do you have one?
We got to use the low from yesterday for the S&P now, as you kind of realign in the sand. It's just a matter of how far can this bounce from an oversold condition take us. I'm unconvinced for now, barring, today's a good birthday, but there's a lot more work to be done. I don't have much on yields. There hasn't been a call on yields for quite some time now. I do think it was interesting you had a softer CPI and yields popped anyway. And things like utilities were still up. They're not outperforming today. But I think it's too hard to make a call on long duration right now because it's just there's been no trend there.
Range bound yields actually, should be good for risk assets. It creates a certainty that the market craves right now, except we just have the Washington uncertainty that is every day is something new.
Well, there's just a little bit of Washington uncertainty. Let's not overplay that, Ryan.
There's still plenty of demand for short duration because you're getting 4% there and no volatility. So that's just a far easier thing to take advantage of right now.
On a completely different topic, I did see The Economist, as you know, has this foolishly complex model-based, poll-based forecast of election results, and they have shown the conservatives in Canada earlier in the week 10 points behind, and now I think they're 5 points behind in closing that gap. Donald Trump might not make Canada a state, but the Liberals might pull out a surprising victory in Canada, courtesy of Donald Trump's efforts to, even when he's joking, right? He drove Steve Leisman and CNBC crazy, even when he's joking about making Canada a state. So there's all kinds of unintended consequences out there. Is there anything else, gentlemen, that you think is sort of important this week?
I actually this headline kind of came across just came across now, but it goes to the tune of inflation. But it appears that the California Insurance Commissioner said he plans to approve a 22% emergency rate increase for State Farm policyholders. That is not associated with 2%
That's
inflation.
not good.
Well, it's a small number, and insurance costs are going up. Now, higher insurance costs tend to be bullish for the insurance business, not bearish, right?
I think it's an insurance industry is very interesting here, because it's going to be able to pass along those price increases. It's a little more defensive, in nature overall, and so and then also they could potentially could benefit from the deregulation that's so widely expected to happen for the financial firms.
Insurers, they rank well technically for what that's worth. I'll tell you that much. They've been a good spot as the rest of the, especially the asset managers have corrected.
So before we go, value is found within the S&P primarily, I guess, in the energy sector, which is about 2% of the overall index now. And John Byrne, our colleague, had an interesting report on natural gas versus coal, that in the United States, which has done a great thing to clean up the air by courtesy of Mr. Market, by having low natural gas prices, making it far more competitive with coal, now he sees that perhaps at the beginning of a change. And he came out with a view that maybe the coal companies, and he looked at some MLPs associated with them too, that were yielding 11%, are great buys here. Thoughts?
Yeah, I mean the coal industry is pretty interesting, largely because it's actually what a lot of the policies that get talked about in Washington take multiple years to get implemented, but the changes that could happen within the coal industry could happen quite quickly. One of the things that they have the ability to do is they have the ability to bring back on the coal-fired power plants, which could help offset some of the net electricity generation needs that this country is so dire for. The EPA, a lot of the EPA pollution standards could get rolled back via executive order. And so, those are two things that the Trump administration could ultimately do relatively quickly. The other thing that may look look more it may be more optics than anything, but we generally are running at the 5-year average, the top of the end of the 5-year average when it comes to coal exports. And if Trump wants to say, hey, this is a domestic industry, we want to use these resources domestically, he could turn that into a nice narrative for which looks like it's benefiting the middle, the middle of America.
Well, of course, Middle America has to benefit because there's also a report out today that the oceans are rising. The models that they use, which are terribly complex and consist of 100% accurate information, the surf evidently has grown from 0.17, which was the estimate, to 0.23. So maybe there's a shore property we could buy 12 or 15 miles away from the ocean, anticipating all that other good stuff with burning more coal. All right, my friends, I have nothing else to share with you unless you have something to share with me, and we'll try to add some value if we're even adding any value here next week.
It was always a
That's
pleasure.
what I got.
All right, thank you, my friends.